So what I'm going to do is actually not talk a lot about the book, but set up the context for the book. And the context for the book, or at least the book, is meant to intervene in the ongoing discussion and debates around the use of migrant labor in Canada, but intervene by saying, hey, what about the workers? What about resistance of the workers? What about the resistance struggles of the workers and their allies? So a number of us have been talking for a number of years about doing this project and about moving forward in this way. And, of course, there's a number of committed activists and activist scholars who have been engaged in these struggles for a long time. And so what we wanted to do was start that discussion with this book. And so the book is a tool for organizing and for extending that discussion both within academe and also within local communities. So what I want to do then is just situate that. So, and I'm going to do that in the context of the sort of discussions of and the sort of great and important renewal of scholarly discussion on Canada's role in global affairs. Within that, we see folks who are actually now saying Canada is an imperialist or sub-imperialist force in the world. And that comes from an understanding of our sort of heightened awareness of the devastation and destruction of Canadian capital, particularly in resource extractive mining in Latin America, but also in finance as well. And so the ever-present expansionist logic of capital has intensified under neoliberal globalization, and that has been facilitated by the Canadian state through practices and commitments. One of the best examples, of course, is Canada's role in the international financial institutions, right, and the promotion of structural adjustment imposed on the global south. But somewhat buried in this renewed discussion is an understanding of where and how labor fits. There's a need to extricate and centralize labor in the Canadian imperialism story, and in particular migrant labor. And in this, then, we want to see Canadian states' imperialist or imperialistic aspirations as a story of the exploitation and expropriation of labor, land, and the resources which run with it. Neoliberal capitalist imperialism, understood in terms of the productive rendering of labor, or pacification, as I say, is an imposition of market dependency such that the means of survival for people, right, understood in terms of production, but also, quite importantly, in terms of reproduction, are subjected to the disciplinary imperatives of the market exchange relations, or market exchange relations, and the predatory dictates of capital. So in an attempt to take seriously Canadian state imperialism, in this discussion today, I'll turn to Canada's role as a primary or desirable immigration destination to examine its imperialistic aspirations and practices articulated through its approach to temporary labor migration. Imperialist powers, including Canada, intervene to dispose of the civilizational failures it uncovers throughout the world. And that imposition, as Todd Gordon has noted, at home and abroad, has produced racialized articulations of global capitalist development. And that racist capitalism, or that racialized capitalism, is the ongoing order of business, and it remains the order of the day. It's most evident in the persistence of, as I call, and lots of other folks have been calling, global economic apartheid, right? The racialized structural inequality that occurs on a global scale. So evident within this story of the sort of capitalist imperialism and Canada's role in it are Canada's temporary labor migration programs, right? We can fit this into a wider story then of Canada's civilizing missions. Canada's earlier large-scale civilizing missions, its foundational colonization of indigenous peoples and traditional territory, formalized through the construction of a system of reserve lands and reserve peoples, has been followed by successive civilizing missions. Not so much that the original civilizing mission has given way to this contemporary temporary labor migration one, but these missions stand in relation to each other, and I want to talk about that today. Ultimately, my claim is that These civilizing missions are in fact part of the ongoing project of the formation and perpetuation of capitalist Canada. Project Canada is indeed a series of projects of pacification. Project Canada is constitutive, or another way of saying it is Project Canada is constitutive of successive projects of pacification. Pacification and apartheid are handmaidens of capital accumulation. And in this, I want to tell the story about the role of law and the state, how there's an interplay here between labor, land, and law in the construction of this pacification. So, in this paper, I start with Sharman Wright's quite important discussion and deployment of the idea of the commons and a practice of commoning grounded on mutuality. Then I turn to a discussion to explore Canada's civilizing missions. I won't talk through all of them today, and the paper is still in its formative stages, and so quite crude, I must admit, and I am certainly looking for feedback on that. Then I'll turn to talk about the temporary foreign worker program, making some emphasis on the seasonal agricultural workers program, which I term the next top model regime of pacification, one that's highly dependent on and in turn reproducing global apartheid. I think quite pivotally in this discussion, I'll talk about the relationship between Canada's civilizing missions and in this, the work of claiming and keeping land, which is the work of labor and the work of law. And in this, we see the foreign migrant other meeting the indigenous other, and I'll talk through some of the implications of that. So then, as a point of departure, the paper set within the context of the decolonizing anti-racism debate, which is evident most notably in a recent scholarly dust-up over the marginalized place of indigenous self-determination struggles within anti-racist frameworks, right? Of course, we're talking here about, in particular, Lawrence and Dua's intervention and the response from Sharma and Wright. And certainly this, the debate itself, and especially Sharma and Wright's intervention, are quite controversial in its radical and polemical nature. But rather than viewing arguments, these arguments, this debate in binary or either or terms, with the aim of seeking some kind of prompt resolution of the conflict, I suggest that we need to hold both sets of accounts together at the same time, not in a liberal sort of sense of seeking some kind of balance, but strictly in terms of recognizing the contingent and strategic and often sometimes contradictory nature of anti-capitalist, anti-racist, anti-colonial, anti-imperialist struggles. So that said, I want to start with Sharma and Wright, where Sharma and Wright end. And that's not as a way of extending their claim per se, but as an opportunity to revise and double back on their account. Strictly with a view towards opening up space for law, political economy of law in particular, and actually a Marxist political economy of law account, an anti-racist Marxist political economy account. So focused on what they term the practices of decolonization that are contingent, focused on what they term practices of decolonization that are fundamentally anti-racist and toward an anti-racist politics fully contingent of the necessity of anti-capitalist decolonization, Sharma and Wright argue that there are liberatory strategies of critique and practice that do not reproduce the ruling strategies of colonial modernity, the colonial state, and nationalisms, and that open up space for radical critique and resistance. They identify this as a practice of commoning, and of course give this as one such example, and the aim of which is to organize human activity through, as they say, a vesting of all property in the community and organizes labor for the common benefit of all. The key to commoning, as they say, is the nurturing of relationships of mutuality, right? Mutuality with fellow commoners. And they're following Linbaugh here, where they recite the four key principles that are historically evident in the practices of commoning and in the rights held by commoners. The first being, and I'm going to go through these quite quickly, focusing on the fourth. The first is common rights are embedded in a particular ecology that relies on local knowledge. Commoning is embedded in a labor process and is entered into by labor. Commoning is collective. And the fourth, which again I will focus on, commoning is independent of the state and law. My intervention then can be framed as a question, does mutuality go far enough? So certainly I acknowledge, as to borrow a line from Martin Luther King Jr., we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. Yet mutuality embodies the contradictory nature of capitalism, appearing as much as an expression or even defense of capitalist relations and private property as a response to it. Laws deployed to disrupt or interfere with our inescapable mutuality insofar as it denounces or opposes collective engagement and resistance of workers in forms decided upon by workers themselves, and insofar as it forecloses possibilities for workers to band together to refashion material conditions in transformative ways, and insofar as it channels behavior diverting efforts grounded in radical or militant mutuality into more palatable forms. So law is always in play in shaping mutuality. Even in its apparent absence, law is present. And of course, a quick example of this is the sort of post-war labor law regime, which forces unionized workers to jump through all kinds of hoops, temporal hoops and otherwise, to exercise their collective right to withdraw their labor power. And certainly within that regime, it also empowers union elites to discipline the rank and file, right, with the objective of stopping the wildcat strike. There cannot be wildcat strikes. So certainly the union movement is an example of mutuality, but it's not an example always of radical mutuality. So the critical task then is to sort through competing understandings of mutuality, and search for, seek out a radical reorientation of popular construction of mutuality for explicitly oppositional ends. So this is what I'm calling militant or radical mutuality. While necessary for the pursuit of emancipatory politics, mutuality is not sufficient on its own. Taken as a given, our interconnectedness and interdependence, people must struggle together to devise strategies which confront head-on the hierarchical and dehumanizing nature of capitalist order. And in this, I'm thinking about David Featherstone's quite recent book, Solidarity, Hidden Histories and Geographies of Internationalism, where he talks about, quite importantly, returning to Marx, internationalism from below, right? Not internationalism from above. The idea here is not to undermine class-entrenched organizing. This is, of course, pivotal to confronting the racialized class articulations of contemporary capitalist imperialism, but to see again that law and state are present. So then, starting from the premise that the Canadian state is an imperialist and apartheid state, grounded on a rejection of the myth of benevolence in which Project Canada is shrouded, right? Peacekeeper abroad, peacemaker at home. I aim to deeply problematize belonging in the territory known as Canada, focusing on the ways in which law and the state function to undermine or de-radicalize mutuality, and alternatively, how law seeks to insert reformist forms of mutuality for the purposes of facilitating capital accumulation. So within this, I use a notion of the structures of living together. The ways in which, and I boy, this is a borrowed concept, but I sort of divert it for different ends. And in the structures of living together, we see ways in which law and the state construct, regulate, mediate, enforce, perpetuate certain forms of belonging and mutuality over others. I've got the time signal, so what I want to do is actually just jump over sort of Canada's first top model, its first civilizing mission of creating, of colonizing Indigenous peoples and the theft of Indigenous lands, and sort of move on to Canada's next top model, the temporary labor migration scheme. So much is made of Canada's temporary foreign worker program. The TFWP is a model of best practices in migration management. We see this coming from the Canadian state and from employers. We've seen this in the 2009 UN Human Development Report. There's all kinds of people singing the praises of Canada's temporary labor migration scheme. None of this, of course, appreciates how the structures of living together organize migrant workers and construct them through differentiated incorporation or inclusion in the social relations of production in Canada. The Temporary Foreign Worker Program turns on the deployment of unfree migrant labor, whereby the dull economic compulsion, understood by Marx as a general feature of capitalism, is sharpened. It's sharpened through the political legal compulsion, and particularly here we're talking about the use of migratory status, as some people have talked about, or the work permit and authorization. And certainly here in the unfreeing of workers, we're talking about how they are tied to specific employers and to the labor market and specific segments within that labor market, and they're denied the flexibility of geographic mobility. They can't freely circulate geographically or within the labor market. And this, of course, is done in racialized terms. Processes through which this unfreeing occurs are both racialized and racist, in part because of the sort of use of the Global South, which has been constructed or conceived in racialized terms, the darker nations, as Vijay Prasad has talked about. And in this is certainly reflecting on both drawing upon and perpetuating global apartheid. In the crossing of borders, again, we see the construction of racialized labor. And as they're slotted on a consistent basis into the bottom, lower rungs of the labor market, we see the racist dimensions of this regime. So therefore, we see that migrant labor workers are filtered through the structures of living together, and on this, I say, as a means of pacification. Foreign labor is rendered productive in unfree, migrant, and racialized terms. So that rendering of foreign labor as productive for Canadian capital is, of course, orchestrated by the Canadian state. But it's not just orchestrated by the Canadian state. Sending states, of course, have their role in this. And so now we are talking about a transnational legal regulatory dynamic that's in play. Mohapatra, the Indian social historian, has talked about mobilized to immobilized. And here we can see that the Temporary Foreign Worker Program works to mobilize workers to cross territorial borders, only to have those workers immobilized within Canada. And the sending states, of course, do a great deal of the heavy lifting in that process. And it's important to see that process through the lens of the hierarchy of the national state system and, of course, uneven global capitalist development. So in my last few minutes, let me make this link between, although I didn't talk a lot about the first civilizing mission, the last civilizing mission. And here I'm focused on the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program, but also the agricultural stream within the Temporary Foreign Worker Program. And it's quite important to see that paramount to the project of Canada is the use of agricultural labor. The work of clearing and cleansing the land was and remains central to that project. Chris Tomlins, a sociolegal historian, in a fantastic book called Freedom Bound, alerts us to the intricacies of the English colonizing project's transformation of mainland North America. In his words, labor was essential to colonizing because labor constructed the means of keeping. Labor transformed the face of the land. Keeping, of course, is a legal notion, and as Tomlins says, law would determine who kept what. So law and labor worked in concert to condition and enforce the structures of living together. Certainly in line with Tomlin's account, it becomes evident that the work of manning, planting, and keeping is not done. That's his phrase, by the way. It's not done. It's ongoing. Agriculture labor is used to work the land, and in working the land, private ownership is claimed, and of course, surplus value is extracted. To this end, migrant agricultural labor programs become a means of enforcing a central tenet of capitalism, private property, of course, through an assertion of it. As well, in this way, migration programs work to continue colonial displacement and dispossession of indigenous peoples, and then here we are met with the foreign migrant other meeting the indigenous other. The settler, as Fanon famously put it, owes the fact of his very existence, that is to say, his property, to the colonial system. The structural existence of migrant labor today under the Seasonal Agricultural Worker Program is indicative of how the structures of living together function to slot the foreign migrant other into the role of settler, but not granted full settler status. The hierarchical nature of settler relations is quite important for us to recognize. And the need, and in this we see the need for labor to bring those relations into being. But that certainly is not the end of the story. Lorenzo Veracini, in his recent work on settler colonialism, attempts to draw a sharp analytical distinction between colonialism and settler colonialism. We see, certainly in the SOP, something contrary to that nature. That is to say that in practice, in the SOP, the structures of living together, which shape how we relate to one another, is evidence that such a sharp distinction between settler colonialism and colonialism cannot be drawn in practice. And so ultimately, then, my claim is that Canada's Seasonal Agricultural Worker Program, while reinforcing settler colonialism, also reproduces a distinct form of relations of hyper-exploitation and domination, or in a word, neocolonialism. In this way, the histories of settler colonialism and colonialism converge within the SOP and within the project that we call Canada. Thank you.